Welcome to episode 304 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Andrew Swafford,
Jessica Carr,
Michael O'Malley.
And in today's episode, we will be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1939's The Story of the Last Chrysanthemum. Actually, I've seen it in plural as well. So it's either The Story of the Last Chrysanthemum or Mums. I don't know. One of them.
Wait, so anyway. That answers the question that I had at the end of the movie, which is that is the plural of chrysanthemum chrysanthema, which I guess it's not.
Glad you used that joke at the beginning.
We also had the question, who is the chrysanthemum? And I guess the answer could be both of them.
The chrysanthemum.
The friends they made along the way.
There you go. That's the chrysanthemums that you meet along the way. That's who it is. Let's go ahead and jump into movies that we saw this week. And we're going to talk about the latest Spike Lee movie that is on Netflix. But I say we'll go ahead and cap off the first part with that. Jessica, let's start with you. You caught a very timely movie that fans of Parasite and Bong Joon-ho should definitely check out, because it's worth seeing if you like that one.
Yeah, so I saw The Host, which is Bong Joon-ho's film from 2006. And like with this movie, it seems like he was trying to do kind of like a monster film, but it is also a Bong Joon-ho film, which means it kind of does things with several different genres. So it centers, it's a lot like Parasite, where it centers on a family, and you have the grandfather who runs like a convenience store, like snack stand, and then you have the dad who is kind of like he's just down on his luck all the time, and he's obviously like just working for the father at the snack stand. And then you have his daughter, and she's a little girl. And then the sister is like an Olympic what's the word? Archer. And then the brother is like just graduated from college and is looking for a job. And it centers on this family, and you're kind of thrown into the action immediately, where their snack stand is by the river. And then there's just a weird, like, squid-like creature that comes out of the water and just starts eating people. Like, just starts swallowing people whole, and then just spitting some of them back out and taking them different places. And the father, like, gets this instinct of, like, I need to start running. And so everyone is running, and he grabs his daughter's hand and keeps going. And then turns around and realizes that he grabbed the wrong little girl's hand, and then looks, and the monster just takes his daughter. And the rest of the film is the family trying to work together to get her back. And there's like a different, like, there's another subplot within that where the government believes that all of the people who came into contact with the monster are infected with some kind of virus, and they quarantine people, but also they are just like gathering them and spraying them down with disinfectant and telling them they can't go anywhere. But the father, who is played by Song Kang-ho, who plays the dad in Parasite as well and is in a lot of Bong Joon-ho films, he does an amazing job, because like actually for most of the film he is captured by the government, and they're doing experiments on him, and they are saying like a bunch of scientists come in and everyone's trying to figure out like if the virus is in him and what it's doing. But the weird thing is that nobody has seen the effects of the virus. Like, there are no symptoms of anything that's happening. And I really liked this film because I feel like it's really relevant with what is going on today. But also, the opening of the film is two morticians, and one of them is an Asian man and one of them is an American man. And he tells the American guy, who's obviously like the Asian guy's boss, tells him like, you need to dump all of this formaldehyde into the sink. And the guy is like, I don't want to do that. Like, that's bad for the environment, and he tells him, well, you need to listen to me, you need to do what I say. And so he pours all of this, like, all of these chemicals down the drain, and he has to wear a gas mask when he's doing it. And I think the whole entire film is kind of, to me, it's kind of about identity and kind of like the Korean identity trying to come through when you have all of these like American ideas floating around. And so there's a part in it where Song Kang-ho's character is literally like yelling at an American doctor saying like, can you not understand what I'm saying? Like, can you not hear me? And so I really think that it's relevant today because there are a lot of people who are being silenced and they're trying to get out what they're saying, but like these higher powers are not listening to them. And it's crazy to me that Bong Joon-ho would like make this in 2006 and it would still be relevant years later. So it's a really, really good film. I still have I still have two of his films to watch. I haven't seen Mother, and I haven't seen, I think it's, is it Barking Dogs Never Bite? Is this first film?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it.
Have you seen Memories of Murder?
I haven't seen that one either, so I have three.
That is very good. Would recommend.
I think most of his stuff is on Hulu along with Parasite.
Yeah, the host is on Hulu. That's where I watched it. And I know that Mother is also on Hulu because that was also on my list.
Yeah. I don't know if we've talked about it extensively on the podcast, but yeah, Memories of a Murder is really good. I think it's on Amazon Prime, and it has, is it the inspiration in terms of like how it was made for Zodiac or vice versa or something like that? If you like Zodiac, the David Fincher film, you will like Memories of a Murder.
Yeah, they're very similar.
One of those.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting also to just see how he's grown as a director. I think that that happens a lot where like something like Parasite hits and it gets people like on his radar or gets him on their radar, and then they start to work backwards and start watching his filmography. So I myself am also trying to do that and trying to watch more of his films. So I think that The Host is a really great one to check out.
I'll be interested what you think when you get all the way back to his debut, The Barking Dogs Never Bite. That one feels like an outlier in a lot of ways, stylistically and maybe with the plot too. It's pretty out there.
Yeah, I also had a really hard time with Mother too. So maybe you could explain that one to me if you get around to it soon.
Yeah, for sure.
Very cool. Well, Andrew, you wanted to talk about a movie that actually... it's now streaming on Criterion Channel, but it's been kind of widely difficult to find for a long time.
Right, so kind of special. I am back on my bullshit this week, recommending a extremely long, somewhat challenging, left-field art house film. And that is Celine and Julie Go Boating by Jacques Rivette. And I am on the record on this podcast when we did our episode on Duel, as like not really getting Jacques Rivette, not really knowing what to do with him, not being particularly like thrilled by what he did in that movie. But I think maybe I should have started here. I think this is a really compelling, really engrossing film. And it's a hard film to talk about because so much of what's great about it is kind of the unfolding nature of the movie, the sense of discovery, like realizing what this movie is about, because it kind of plays its, it keeps its cards very close to the vest. But I will explain the basic plot up to a point and then kind of talk about what I enjoyed about it and what it made me think about a little bit. So it starts with this very long shot of one of the female protagonists sitting on a park bench reading a book about magic, like occult magic. She just like sits on the park bench for a really long time. And it's not one of these like slow cinema long takes where you're just watching her do nothing for 10 minutes. Like, the camera keeps, like, looking around the park. It seems like there's something we're supposed to be noticing here, but you don't really notice anything, and this goes on for many minutes. And then eventually another woman walks by, the other female protagonist. She drops something, and she keeps walking, and then the girl who is reading the magic book gets up, and she grabs the thing, and she tries to return it to the woman, but then the woman just starts running. And it's like this very interesting, like, abrupt jump into the world of these women. Like, she tries to return this possession, the woman just starts running away from her and, like, dropping a lot of other things along the way, and it becomes this, like, 15-20 minute chase sequence that you don't really understand, like, why it's even happening. And then eventually they, like, sit down at in a restaurant together, and they seem very cordial, and you're just like, what is the relationship between these women? I'm so confused. You later find that one of them is a magician, not the one that was reading the book about magic, but the other one is a magician. And the one who was reading the book about magic is a librarian. And they have this strange, undefined, sisterly relationship. And at a certain point in the movie, one of them makes an appointment to go to this house. It's kind of unclear why she goes to the house. But when she comes out of the house, she's extremely dazed and seems disoriented, not exactly sure, like, where or when she is. And she has this piece of candy in her mouth that she doesn't know how it got there. And then she, after this point in the movie, the film begins to be intercut with these brief fragmented glimpses at what seems like a completely different movie, shot differently, lit differently, completely different cast. Though you will notice, like, one or two people kind of in the background of shots, they're like, hey, I know that actor from the movie that I'm watching. And the movie eventually kind of reveals how these two like cinematic worlds are related to one another. But again, it's like in the discovery of how that connection is made is kind of the exciting thing about this. It's a long film. It is 3 hours and 15 minutes, and you will spend the first hour and a half just, like, completely confused what or why you are watching. But I promise there is a serious payoff, and, like, the entire movie kind of becomes this larger-than-life amazing experience by the end. It's some of the most fun I've had watching a movie in this pandemic quarantine situation I'm in. It's not shot particularly like impressively. It feels like it's made with almost like a home movie camera or something. The version I watched was kind of low res. Maybe the version on Criterion Channel is a little bit more glossy. But Jacques Rivette kind of has this almost documentary style with how he shoots the bizarre lives of these women. It doesn't seem like he's trying to do any, like, overly impressive, like, auteur cinematography moves, but it's kind of the overall construction of the movie as, like, a time-based story is kind of what is ultimately very interesting about it. And I feel like there are a lot of it ends up being a movie about movies in a way, but different in a very different way than I feel like most movies about movies are. With movies like Sunset Boulevard or even like Mulholland Drive, which is a movie that Celine and Julie Gauboding has been compared to, these are often movies about making movies and kind of the seedy underbelly of the movie making machine. But Celine and Julie Gauboding, one of the only films I've ever seen that seems to capture something very essential about the experience of watching movies and the nuances and the significance of the act of watching a film. And the other movies I might put in that category would be like Siming Lang's Goodbye Dragon Inn, which is kind of about the stasis of like the theatrical experience. And maybe like David Lynch's Inland Empire, which eventually kind of gets to a point where it's about like the emotional connection you make with a film. And Celine and Julie Gauboding, I don't know. I'm going to need to think about it a little bit longer, but it seems to be doing something to represent like the act of watching a movie with like a significant other, you know, the act of sharing movies you love with other people, and the feeling of being transported into a film as you're watching it. So it's like really interesting, really unique stuff. And now that it's available on Criterion Channel, I guess for the first time in a very long time that's been widely available, I would strongly suggest people check it out. Even if you've never watched a Rivette movie, or if you've seen some Rivette in the past and struggled with it, I think that this is definitely worth your time. So that is my recommendation. Celine and Julie,
go nice. Voting. Yeah, I've heard people talking about that this is one that people should check out, especially right now where you have a little bit more time than usual to be watching 3 hour and 15 long movies.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
If you have Criterion Channel, it is available there. But let's go ahead and move on to the latest film from Spike Lee, which is now available on Netflix, and that is the Da Five Bloods, which follows these four African-American Vietnam veterans who return to Vietnam. They are searching for the remains of their squad leader, who's played by Chadwick Boseman in these flashback sequences. They're looking for his remains after he had died in a battle in Vietnam, but they also are there to try to find this buried treasure that was also left behind, so that they can they kind of use the a little bit of the guise of returning the remains of their squad leader to also find these millions of dollars stowed away in gold. Out in Vietnam. And so they come back there. It's very much kind of a, old friends coming together movie for a lot of the first 30 minutes or so, as they kind of just reconnect before they actually go into the jungle to start the actual journey. And then after that, you know, naturally things start to kind of go awry, and the movie very much becomes a lot much more than just the basic kind of elevator pitch plot of these guys going back to Vietnam to find this buried treasure and their fallen squad leader. It becomes more about the lasting legacy of the Vietnam War, what it meant for African Americans who went over to fight in that war while the civil rights movement was happening in America at the same time, and kind of what America is viewed as in the country of Vietnam, especially through the lens of that, of what they call in the movie the American War. But this one stars Delroy Lindo, Jonathan Majors from The Last Black Man in San Francisco, Clark Peters, Isaiah Whitlock Jr., who I love that Spike Lee just really leans into Isaiah Whitlock Jr. doing his like very famous, very long-winded shit, you know, like just, and he like really leans into it. And yeah. Because I rewatched two other recent Spike Lee movies, and he does the same thing in those two as well. Michael,
he actually also does it in the Wire, which there's also
That's where I think
the Wire as well.
Yeah, I think that's where, like, or at least that was the first time I saw him do that. Like, that was the big thing, was Isaiah Whitlock Jr. in the Wire just would do that over and over and over again.
But I think by the end of the Wire, it had gotten to where that would stretch out for like 10 seconds.
It was kind of comical. And so I like that Spike Lee kind of gives it like this panache to it. But Michael, I wanted to start with you. What did you make of The Five Bloods and this latest from Spike Lee?
I really liked it. I mean, it's a lot of movie, like I think most Spike Lee movies are. But like Spike Lee seems to be back in the realm of like kind of recognizably Hollywood budgets after kind of being in the wilderness up through like maybe like right before Chirac with like Red Hook Summer or something like that. So like this movie is like, it looks really lush in ways that like recent Spike Lee has maybe not. It doesn't have like that kind of like DIY like a digital video look that like some of his like Kickstarter stuff had, and looks a lot more like the movies which it references, which are like Apocalypse Now and The Deer Hunter and stuff like that. And I think it's really cool to see Spike Lee being able to play with this much, this many resources again, because I think as this movie shows, like, he is intent on like pushing those resources to the max to say like literally everything he can think of about whatever topic he has. And it's a lot. And like, I think the standard like critical like boilerplate about like any Spike Lee movie of the past maybe like 20 years is that like it's messy, and like this is definitely like a messy movie. There's like long stretches, especially toward the beginning, that I think feel kind of meandery, and it's not clear like exactly how it all fits together. And then he's got his kind of like didacticism as well, where like they mention like some like Vietnam War atrocity, and then he'll flash on the screen like archival footage of that, where it's like almost like a
some really gruesome footage.
Yeah, like there's the really famous footage of the guy like just shooting the dude in the head. I don't know if like how I don't exactly know the context of that, except I've seen it in other stuff before. And yeah, like, you know, mutilated children and that sort of thing. And like it reminds me of the end of Black Klansman, where he inserts like the Charlottesville Nazi rally
footage.
And the the protester who was killed in that, and we like see her get hit by the car and stuff. And so like the difference I think in this movie, because I had like a little bit of a problem with that. Like I thought it worked thematically, but I also thought it was maybe like a cheap shot to like just show you somebody dying without like a real warning, which I guess is again the effect. But like with Vietnam, I feel like that, you know, me as someone who grew up in like the 90s and 2000s, you hear about Vietnam and people are like, wow, Vietnam was terrible. It was a quagmire. So many Americans died for no point and all that. And you hear that a lot. And I remember hearing that in my like US history class growing up. But I think there is a real like historical amnesia about like exactly what people were protesting about in the Vietnam War, because it wasn't really like this war is never ending and you know, and I mean, it was a little bit of that, but like there was like very real protests about the atrocities against the Vietnamese and the atrocities done in the name of like capitalism versus communism and that sort of thing, which I definitely did not learn about at all. And so I think that like when Spike Lee is basically being like, know your history, folks, like I think it works for me, because I kind of know more of the history now, like as an adult, but like I definitely feel like I had to do homework to know some of that history, and I still am not very familiar with it. And I think that this movie is also kind of about that amnesia, like people having pushed parts of the war down so deep into themselves that it's starting to like kind of eat them from the inside out.
He did this as well in Black Klansman a lot as also, but he's like kind of working on this level of also commenting on the pop culture and the media versions of, you know, the event. So he's kind of in Black Klansman, he's kind of commenting on how pop culture influenced how how people are seeing Black Americans, through that kind of media representation. And in this one, I mean, you mentioned Apocalypse Now, but he's kind of playing with that kind of movie perception of Vietnam. You know, this isn't Forrest Gump, this isn't Apocalypse Now. Like he's kind of playing with that notion that we kind of expect whenever we see a movie in Vietnam that's kind of taking place in the war, and he's kind of, you know, working against that to deal with our prejudice together.
Well, and I think he like does some really interesting contextual stuff with media too. Like for one, you've got like the pervasive like Marvin Gaye music, you know, and it's mostly his like political stuff, like what's going on and that stuff, which is like just suffuses the movie, kind of like Prince did in Girl Six. And so like that's really interesting, because I think like the popular legacy of Marvin Gaye, like there's a little bit of the political stuff, but people much more remember like Marvin Gaye as like the kind of like sex guru, like, you know, that kind of thing. You know, forefront, like putting that in the forefront of the movie, I think is really interesting. But then also you've got, there's a scene in which we see Hanoi Hannah, the kind of really famous like propagandist, like Viet Cong propagandist radio DJ that would broadcast rock music to the American troops and like soul music and stuff. And so the American troops would have to hear basically it's like Viet Cong propaganda. But also Spike Lee, and I know this because I was reading an interview, but he like basically takes like verbatim like what Hanoi Hannah said when Martin Luther King was assassinated, because the characters in this movie were in Vietnam when that happened. And like what Hanoi Hannah says, like what's like supposedly the Viet Cong propaganda is that you guys are over here fighting us while the U.S. government is fighting your people who are, you know, rioting in protest of Martin Luther King's death. And I think that that's really interesting because usually we hear about Martin Luther King's death, like historically in the media, as the end of the civil rights movement and not in connection with the Vietnam War, even though like Martin Luther King, the last couple of years of his life was like super against the Vietnam War and all, you know, maybe contributed to the motivation for his mm-hmm. assassination and stuff. But I bring this up because like, I watched this documentary today called Winter Soldier, which is like a documentary of the Winter Soldier hearings in like 1971 or 72, which is like a bunch of soldiers who had committed war crimes in Vietnam, like coming and testifying in front of Congress to say like, hey, we committed war crimes. You guys now got to stop this war. And one of the soldiers talks about that when he was in Vietnam, a white soldier, he got a letter from like his girlfriend who told him about Woodstock, and he like cried because Woodstock sounded so beautiful. And I feel like we see that a lot, like Forrest Gump and everything, where like Woodstock is the American counterpart to the Vietnam War. And then this movie, I don't think it's referencing that documentary, but this movie is the opposite. Like black, these black soldiers didn't really have like, you know, they get told of horrible things happening in their, you know, home country and not things to look forward to when they go back. And anyway, I've talked a lot. I'll yield the floor to somebody else. But I like this movie. It's got a lot to talk about and it's really interesting.
I want to talk real quickly about something that you mentioned at the top, where because I saw this comment about this movie, but also I think just a lot of Spike Lee movies in general, where film critics like to go, I like it, but it's kind of messy. Kind of looking at especially his recent output, whether it's Chirac or Black Klansman or this, that seems to be somewhat of an unfair. Well, mainly to me, I was thinking about it as just kind of a very nearsighted way to be looking at movies or popular culture. It's like that there has to be like this clean, streamlined vision, and that's how you. That's the output of the movie or the whatever piece of art that you're watching. That seems especially unfair for like to kind of place on a black director who's like grappling with all of these various ideas and such. And, you know, I'm not going to disagree that Spike Lee's throwing a bunch of different things at you. But it's kind of like, it's definitely a movie that's constantly in conversation with itself and many different things all at once. And to me, that kind of makes it fascinating. Granted, that's kind of, you know, generally where my mind is, where I'm just tossing various things all at once and there's not really a streamlined thought process going through it. And so I kind of respect that on that level. But at the same time, I think that his movies, there's something to be commended about that the messiness is kind of some of the point that he's trying to get across, that there is a little bit of these kind of blurring, delineating lines between everything. The way that he kind of presents, like Michael, like you were talking about, the African-American soldiers in Vietnam, and you have back in America, you have the U.S. government pretty much waging war on black Americans. Then you have the black Americans who are in Vietnam waging war against the Viet Cong. But then at the same, as they point out to the four main characters, at the same time, the Vietnamese are just there trying to fight off the colonialist imperialist French who are in their region. They're trying to, you know, break away from their oppressors there. And so it's like this constant cycle of of ways that people are trying to overcome things and also trying to make sense of the various ways that kind of imperialism seeps into everything that they've really known or made sense of. And so it's a very messy movie, but I also feel like that's a very disingenuous thing to say about a director like Spike Lee.
Yeah, and like for sure, like I think also like the fact that he doesn't need to like wrap everything up tightly, which I will say like this is a much tighter movie than some of his other movies, like Chirac maybe, for instance. And I think as a result of that, this movie feels a lot more expansive than Vietnam movies sometimes do. Like if you compare this like Platoon or something like that, or even The Deer Hunter, like those movies feel tiny in comparison to like the thematic scope of this movie, like which is like basically the whole arc of like American imperialism and European imperialism like contained within this movie. But yeah, anyway.
Well, I just watched this movie today in preparation for the podcast, and my thoughts on it are, forgive me, it's a little messy. And I don't necessarily think that it's messy in the same way as some of Spike Lee's other films are. Like, I don't think Black Klansman is a particularly messy movie. I don't think Chirac is a particularly messy movie. This one is a bit messy not in terms of like messaging, right? Because the topic of the intersection between Vietnam and civil rights is a complicated one. And so of course the messaging is going to be a little complex and all over the place. But in terms of just like a movie, the kind of movie we're watching kind of changes a lot. There's a lot of tonal shifts. There's a lot of genre shifts. You know, on the one hand, we're kind of watching this old men get the gang back together kind of movie, like Last Vegas or Going in Style or something. And we're also watching a Vietnam movie like Platoon or Apocalypse Now. And then we're also watching this like treasure hunty Western movie, like Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And then like the format is jumping around a lot. He like changes the aspect ratio to show different time jumps. Sometimes we're watching digital cinematography. Sometimes we're watching like really grainy celluloid cinematography. And he's also like putting in all these like multimedia artifacts as well. It opens with video footage of Muhammad Ali kind of giving his famous quote about having no quarrel with the Vietnamese. It ends with a footage of Martin Luther King talking about the importance of like changing the soul of America, and then there's all this other like archival footage that's spliced in all the time, and I think that even just like on a plot level, this thing kind of veers off in a lot of different directions. Like it kind of follows a pretty simple trajectory up until the fact where the point where they find the treasure and they find the corpse of Chadwick Boseman's character, and then it kind of becomes this like cat and mouse thing where people start hunting them and everybody kind of goes off in different directions and everybody has their own story, and some of those stories are kind of like break reality and include a lot of like monologuing to the camera, which I don't know how much of that stuff worked for me. And I do really appreciate the movie as like a history piece, like you were saying, Michael, as a history lesson of sorts, as a subversion or a rewriting of the story that we tend to tell on screen about Vietnam. But as a movie, it didn't really like cohere to me in a particularly satisfying way. And I appreciate the messaging and I appreciate the politics of the film, but in terms of like there's a lot of great Spike Lee movies, and this doesn't really feel like one I will probably go back to because of how all over the place it feels. But I don't know. Does any of that feel unfair? Am I giving the you know, the uncharitable reading of what Spike is doing here?
I think for me, I don't know if it's uncharitable or not. For me, the movie really started working once they found the gold, because then you, then I think like all that reality breaking, I think really throws into relief like exactly what the movie is trying to be about, and like the style starts matching like the themes in more interesting ways than like the movie is very like genre-y going leading up to that, which isn't necessarily bad, but the movie like kind of breaks its genre like once you find the gold, and it like fractures and like
what kind of fractures in a way that like it doesn't like it had at least not necessarily one firm shape, but like several firm shapes that it was jumping back and forth between. And then once they find the gold and it starts fracturing, it kind of becomes sort of formless and shapeless in general. Like I found myself getting really bored in the last hour of the film because it didn't feel like there was any clear direction we were going. We're just kind of just like jumping back and forth between these people in various states of like uncertainty.
I mean, I do feel like there's a lot of jumping, but I think that like, for me at least, like it gets extremely like emotionally poignant, like when the characters start, like when it starts jumping back and forth among these characters, and you can see them kind of almost drifting apart. And sometimes in really like traumatic ways, like the Delroy Lindo character, like basically goes off on his own and kind of has like a Kurtz moment, like from Apocalypse Now or Heart of Darkness or something like that. And I think that like that is like one of the most like riveting things in like definitely this movie and like, you know, of like recent Spike Lee, like his like solo expedition into the jungle where he's kind of like doing this like free associative monologue about like all the various like psychological pressures and traumas that he's experienced like as a black man. He's also like a Trump supporter, and like there's just like a really fascinating like pileup of themes. And then it's revealed at one point like there's like reality breaking stuff where he is saying something, but something different is actually happening to him. So we're like inside his head, and then we like go outside of his head, and you get these weird contrasts between that. And like, it's, I think that that's like the heart of the movie there is like this guy, like basically losing himself, and like losing his sense of self, as at the same time, he's like trying to gun down like Vietnamese people, and they're trying to gun down him. Like that's just like the emotional core of the movie. And I like in that moment, I just got extremely caught up in what was happening.
For me, the like formal conceit of him delivering this like tangle of thoughts to the camera as the stream of consciousness monologue, it kind of took me out of the experience rather than pulling me in. But I do want to talk a little bit about like that character's politics in contrast to the Chadwick Boseman's character's politics, because there is like a very clear contradiction, right, between the sort of radical politics he advocates for in terms of like black liberation and civil rights, and the kind of reactionary politics he engages in terms of the way he talks about Vietnamese people and the way he talks about Mexican immigrants as a Trump supporter. And that's like an interesting tension because, and you can also like make, Michael and I were texting about the connections that can be drawn between him and Kanye West, who like there's a, he writes a check for $2 million at one point, which is the exact amount of money that Kanye West donated to Black Lives Matter or like bail funds in the wake of the George Floyd protests. But I had a harder time putting my finger on Chadwick Boseman's character, who is sort of positioned as the moral center of the movie. And everybody looks up to him, both in the moment and in their memories, as this kind of prophetic messianic figure who's kind of like giving them some sort of like spiritual and political wisdom. They're getting this like political awakening through the speeches that he gives when they're in Vietnam. But he also is a guy who seems to like truly believe in the cause. Like he's kind of like pushing his troops further and further into the jungle because like they gotta hold on. They're fulfilling this noble task. And even after the really great radio monologue, which I thought was one of the strongest moments in the movie, that kind of like shows the total hypocrisy of that, I never really got a sense of like Chadwick Boseman reckoning with the Vietnam War. There's a moment where he's talking to, or I guess in narration, somebody is talking about him talking about like not to fall for anti-communist propaganda. So like a question I have is like, if this is a guy who like understands the bullshit he's kind of being fed by the United States government in terms of like anti-communist propaganda, like why is he here and like what does he believe in, and like why does he seem to believe in this particular cause? Do you think that that's like a tension that's like put in the movie on purpose? Am I supposed to be critiquing this character, or does the movie just like not delve enough into Chadwick Boseman's character for me to get a read?
I think like realistically on a historical level, it's likely that he was drafted, which is like why he's there. But I don't know. Like I think the movie idealizes, or at least the movie characters idealize him. And like, there's definitely a tension in the movie where these guys kind of go to Vietnam to like almost like relive the glory days or something like that. When they get to Vietnam, they kind of collectively remember like how terrible it was to be there. And so maybe there's a little bit of like a and they like exhume his corpse and stuff, and like there's maybe like a symbolism there. I guess like when I was watching the movie, there's like the idealism of Chadwick Boseman's character, I thought was maybe supposed to be as like a parallel to like the kind of almost messianic legacy of like some of the like 1960s and 70s like counterculture black leaders, like you know Malcolm X or Martin Luther King or you know Bobby Seale or people like that. And you know when you it's really easy to like kind of deify in their legacy in when they died 50 years ago, but when you have to go back and confront the times in which they lived, like it's a lot harder. And so like when they're going back to Vietnam to try to reclaim his body, there's like I feel like a symbolic weight too. You try to reclaim the ground that like you know was covered by this kind of messianic figure that you've kind of like ironed out all of the kinks out of. But there's like it's a lot harder to actually go and live the reality of like what that context. And like, I don't know, there's like something connection to the Trump era. And, you know, we lionize Martin Luther King, but living in the Trump era is harder than lionizing a historical figure or something. I don't know.
I was thinking about like, In a similar way that Black Klansman is kind of a movie about the past and a movie about how we look back on history, one of the like thematic resonances that did stand out to me here that I really liked was kind of the symbolism of things that are buried, and these characters going to dig these things up, and of course there is gold. Kind of buried that you can dig up if you're kind of looking into the past, metaphorically speaking. But there are also landmines, right? These are the things that are buried in the ground that these characters kind of come across. And I really like how much time Spike Lee dedicates to the trouble of the landmines, both like literally and metaphorically. Complicated thoughts about this movie. I don't really know how much I like it or if I like it, but definitely interesting, definitely worth talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, The Five Bloods is on Netflix if you would like to check it out, and we're going to take a short break and we'll be back talking about the story of the Last Chrysanthemum after this.
Cinematary listeners, this is your favorite Filipino podcaster, Jessica Carr. I'm here to let you know about a couple of things that Cinematary offers that you might not know about. First, if you're a fan of what Cinematary is doing, please consider joining us on Patreon. Remember when we weren't clamoring for your dollars? Well, now we're just clamoring for five of your dollars. So please help us and donate to our Patreon, and then you'll get exclusive content from our staff, including our film theory and chill series, where a panel takes a piece of theory each month and deconstructs it before diving into whatever topic is on their mind from the past week. The $5 each month is investment in the website and the podcast, and it goes solely to paying our writers for the reviews each week, so please consider doing it. It's only $5. If you missed an episode of Cinematary or a piece of writing we've had, you should consider signing up for our free newsletter. Each Sunday, we send out a note with the latest podcast episode, piece of Patreon content,
and the last two reviews that we've written at cinematary.com. It's perfect for those of you who are interested in what's happening, and it makes sure that you don't miss a single Cinematary review. Finally, the easiest thing that you can do to help us is to please, please give us a rating and review on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever else you're using to listen to the show. This helps us get more eyeballs and ears on the podcast and the website, and it helps the people know about Cinematary, which is really what we're here for. So to recap, consider donating to our Patreon, sign up for the free newsletter, and give us a rating or review. We would really appreciate if you could do these things. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
And we're back with part two of episode 304 of Cinematary. And in this part, we will be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movie series with 1939's The Story of the Last Chrysanthemum. Directed by Kenji Mizoguchi, from a script by Yoshikata Yoda and Matsutaro Kawaguchi. The film stars Shotaro Hanayagi, Kokichi Takada, and Kakuko Mori. Not bad.
Wow, you did pretty good.
Kunosuke was adopted as an infant by a legendary kabuki actor and is being groomed to follow in his theatrical footsteps. Though his fellow troop members publicly praise him, they privately sneer at his lackluster performances. Otaku, his stepbrother's wet nurse, which they make abundantly clear throughout this movie, is the only one willing to tell Kikunosuke the truth. When his father fires Otaku, Kikunosuke leaves home and, with her encouragement, tries to become a great actor. The film's production happened at a time of transition for Mizoguchi. In 1939, he was appointed a national film consultant in Japan and sent to Manchuria with five other film directors. He also left Toho for Sochiku Studios after several years of success at Toho. The Story of the Last Chrysanthemum is his first film in a trilogy about theater in the Meiji period. It was very successful in Japan and won second prize of Kinema, that's cinema but with a K, Jumpo's list of best films. Mizoguchi was also he also won the Education Ministry Award for the film. Mizoguchi used many long takes in the movie, often lasting up to 6 minutes. He also used many dolly shots for dramatic effects and in order to enhance the emotional state of the characters. Derek Malcolm said that, quote, if Mizoguchi was the poet of women, he was also the poet of houses, rooms, landscapes, and urban vistas. His period detail and sumptuous camera style lent his stories a fantastic naturalism, heightened by an almost musical editing style. Lisa Broad broke down the camera's, the film's camera style for the Oklahoma City Museum of Art, saying, Kiku will hear put-downs of his performance as the director's camera serves to create spaces that combine the on-screen visual field with adjacent off-camera spaces into which the narrative extends in a manner not dissimilar to Mizoguchi favorite Ernst Lubitsch's silent comedies of misunderstanding, such as Lady Windermere's Fan in 1925, and from which characters are able to eavesdrop, whether it is just for such moments when one character overhears another telling someone else a secret, or for those when somebody often initially unseen is being addressed off-screen and will only be revealed following a sudden emphatic panning take. Mizoguchi's film spreads beyond the limits of the frame, the world, which is to say the filmmaker's art does not end with what we see or even with what we hear, but rather exists in a robust combination of visible and invisible, audible and inaudible, that marks the material medium's unique formal specificity. I just had a brain moment. The cinema is both the art of the tangible index and also the unseen or heard reality that continues to exist in relation to what appears on screen. The film got a reprint and was released stateside in 2015, with The New Yorker's Richard Brody calling it one of cinema's great outpourings of imaginative energy, and Jonathan Rosenbaum calling it Mizoguchi's greatest film and praised his, quote, refusal to use close-ups. The theme of female sacrifice that informs most of his major works is given a singular resonance and complexity here. On that note, let's talk a little bit about the film. I know this is our second Mizoguchi. We talked about Ugetsu a few years ago. But yeah, Jessica, what did you make of the movie?
Okay, so like about halfway through this movie, this like quote just like popped into my head and I couldn't stop thinking about it. But the quote is, there can be 100 people in a room and 99 of them don't believe in you, but all it takes is one and it just changes your whole life. And that is a quote from Lady Gaga, because and everybody had turned it into a meme. But yeah, like, so I didn't think that the narrative was as compelling as I wanted it to be, but like I appreciate the craft of the film, and I understand that he is doing something when he chooses to not do close-ups, but I think that it makes it more difficult to be engaged with the film and to really engage with the characters and understand where they're coming from. They're like, I think like me and Andrew and Michael like watched it together, and there was a part where Michael said like it's really hard to tell the characters apart because you don't really get to see close-ups of them and they're all very far away from you, and that is kind of how it feels. But I do understand what he's trying to do with that. I think it's interesting that this story really, I think that one of the themes in it is kind of about like sacrifice. Like as an artist, there are things that you are going to have to sacrifice in order to make great art. And it is only like at the end when he like sacrifices his relationship with what's the lady character's name? Otaku, like when he sacrifices his relationship with her, like he's seen as this like great actor, but he, like they spent those 5 years together and he wasted all of those 5 years that they had together. And then of course, like she coughs, and so you know that that's a signal she's definitely gonna die. And they wasted all that time, like being, I guess like him being like bitter with her, and he, you know, sacrifices like his relationship with her, and but at the end, like he's this great actor, but like at what cost? And like to me, the most interesting thing is that this is an old film, but like that is a theme that you see like in tons of movies. Like,
well, I mean, it's interesting that the Lady Gaga quote you read earlier was her talking about A Star Is Born, right? And this is basically a Star Is Born story, but in a very different cultural context.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think that it is, like, the relationship between the two leads, like, their romance didn't seem like a romance to me at all. And I kind of wonder if that is just either, like, a cultural thing or, like, a time thing of where, you know, like, I think that a lot of, like, Japanese films back then weren't, like, explicitly, like swooning over each other and like I love you. It was kind of more of like a devout love, which you get that with them like towards the end when she's dying, but not really like in any other part of the film. So it was very hard for me to engage with that part of it, but I do understand what he was doing.
I was a little distanced from the romance too. It kind of reminded me of Raging Bull, if you guys have ever seen that, in which like you have these huge jumps in time, and those jumps in time like jump over like basically honeymoon periods and that sort of thing. So like, you know, these people get together and we kind of see the immediate circumstances of them getting together, and then we have a time jump, and they're kind of miserable together. And so any sort of like any of the usual stuff that we would see that would invest us in a romance is kind of skipped over. And we just kind of see the relationship hit these speed bumps over and over again, because those are the moments that the movie chooses to linger on between its time jumps. And I think that's, I mean, that's really interesting. And I don't know where I'm supposed to be emotionally with this movie. Like, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to root for this romance, because I feel like, I don't know, maybe this is just me in the 21st century in America, but I feel like that this is like just an extremely depressing movie about this woman's devotion to a man who ultimately, that ultimately spells her doom, you know? Like that's what I feel like the arc of the movie is. Like, as he is becoming great, she, like, the process by which he becomes great is the process that, like, ruins her life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, there's, like, this psychic, almost this psychic connection between them. Like, as he becomes more successful, she suffers more and more until she's dead and he is this huge phenomenon.
Yeah, and, like, even at the beginning of the movie, like, it's almost like an accident that gets them together. Like, she just happens to be around and, like, just happens to tell him, like, hey, man, I don't really think you're that good at acting.
when she is at her happiest, right?
That's right, that yeah, like, she's the most materially well-off at the beginning of the movie, and she just happens, like, she does...
Well, not materially, I guess.
Well, she's not dying of consumption.
Maybe, but she's still, like, so much lower class than him in terms of
She's not, like, well-off, but she's also not, like, in a miserable marriage or dying of, like, a respiratory disease or something. But she does, at the beginning of the movie, what seems to be, like, the decent human thing to do, which is to be honest with this guy, but it seems like that she does so at the expense of so many things that are, like, just disproportionate to, like, the decency that ends up.
Right. Well, to go back to something that you said earlier and to kind of connect it to some of Jessica's points, you mentioned you weren't really sure how to feel about the romance. And I think that is maybe where Mizoguchi wants you, right? In this state of real tense ambiguity about... A, whether or not this even is a romance, and B, whether or not we are supposed to root for it. Because in the early goings of this relationship, it's not about love or interpersonal connection at all. It's only about his acting. They connect because she says he's a bad actor, and he kind of runs away with her he attempts to run away with her because he wants to have her help him refine his craft. And then later, when they've been separated a while and she reconnects with him, he kind of makes a comment to the point of like suggesting that they're going to get married. They're going to have a relationship together. And she says more or less like, I just came here to help you with your acting. And so it seems like these characters don't even have a romantic love for one another, but they, like, by just force of circumstance because they are kind of stuck together for a long period of time, it eventually kind of becomes a marriage and eventually, like, an abusive relationship. And you're right, Michael, that, like, a lot of the turning points in that relationship are things that we're not given. The Mizoguchi skips over them. And so he's kind of leaving us in the dark on how we're, like, what even this thing is. And to go back to Jessica's point about the camera work and how far away the camera is at all times, I think that's part of it too. Mizoguchi... he's a director that I also, on the record on Cinematary, had a hard time with when I watched Ugetsu. But I think I was expecting something different. I was expecting him to be like this pulp director, kind of like Kaneto Shindo, who I later found out was like a protege of his. But he's really like one of these godfathers of slow cinema, like Ozu and Bresson and Dreyer. And
Transcendental cinema.
First Reformed guy. In Transcendental Style and Cinema, Schrader says that, like, all of the techniques of slow cinema are distancing devices. And here, like, the devices, the cinematic devices Mizoguchi is using is, like, literally distancing you from the characters and distancing you from their emotional state, because we're not getting these close-ups on their emotional reactions to things, because there's not any sort of expressionistic editing to kind of like put us in the mindset and the energy of these people. All we get is, you know, this like tableau of their lives viewed from afar. And there are a couple of moments where the cinematography kind of like hints at the dynamics between them. Like when they first meet each other, the camera is like kind of pops to the side a little bit. It's askew, and it seems to suggest that like this is this guy's life kind of being thrown completely off balance for the first time. But for the most part, it is just sort of leaving it far in front of us as like this ambiguous fable that we are kind of to draw our own conclusions about. And I mean, as someone who like is interested in that form of movie making, I find that really engaging. But I mean, it's a type of engagement that's sort of counterintuitive and paradoxical.
Well, he's like working at this on the same level as kind of what Ozu is doing, but they're very much working in different forms.
Yeah. And thank you for reminding me, because I was going to make a comparison there, because like Ozu has very distinctive camera work too, but Ozu's camera work is like putting you in the family unit, right? The camera is where someone's face would be if someone was sitting down on a tatami mat across the table from someone. And when you're looking at a character, you're looking at them dead in the face, like they are talking to you. Ozu is inviting you into the conversation, into these people's lives. And Mizoguchi is, he's keeping you at a distance. And instead of the camera being like down on the floor, the camera is, in many cases, outside of a window, viewed through stuff that's kind of obscuring your view. And that kind of affects our emotional engagement with the movie, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also, you know, it's, I was laughing earlier when you were describing the relationship, because it's kind of like, Kiku, that's not your girlfriend, that's your agent, you know, that's pretty much what she is.
Yeah, yeah.
Like she's his agent. But he like misconstrues that. It seems like Kiku could desperately use a friend. He seems like he has some social issues, really, you know, struggles to connect with people and such. You know, not totally his fault, because yeah, he goes to like the bar after the performance, and they're like, yeah, this dude sucks at acting. So that probably does a lot on your psyche. Yeah, Mizoguchi is somebody who I struggled with Ugetsu as well, and this one, I think I like this one a little bit more. I think I kind of knew coming in that Mizoguchi kind of leaves you at arm's length. And yeah, again, I was struggling a lot with the whole relationship dynamic, but to me, I don't know, I kind of chalked that up to more of a culture difference. I feel like this is probably very much working on a wavelength that we're uncommon with, and so I was kind of open to recognizing that as well. I think though, it you know, for all of the kind of up and downness that I had for the majority of the runtime, I will say that the final sequence where Otaku is sick and dying, and she's in this house, and he's like gotten back up on the, you know, he's risen back up, has you know, got that acclaim, is now recognized as this great actor, after kind of severing ties with her, and he goes and sees her and like has this like very emotional goodbye with her. I felt like that though, even though, you know, it's like he's kept us at arm's length for this entire runtime, this entire 2.5 almost hour movie, and that last 15 minutes almost like is like the payoff for all of that, because it's like it really does feel like this kind of dam breaking of emotion and, you know, empathy for the two characters is, there's something really almost moving about the way that she, kind of has this joy for him, for where he's at, and it isn't trying, you know, telling him to go be a part of this this parade. And then you hear like just the parade in the background as she's slowly dying. It's a very quiet, sad scene.
Yeah, I mean it's sad, right? It is the moment in the movie where I feel like I know most potently how Mizoguchi wants me to feel, because it is like a unambiguously tragic ending, right? Like there's no way that at that point in the movie you can think that what has happened to her is worth it because of where he has gotten. It almost seems like he is in this moment of deep regret, like, oh God, what have I done? I don't even want this fame. In terms of the how we're supposed to feel about the romantic or like the dynamic, the gender politics of the film, that seems to be Mizoguchi maybe tipping his hand that maybe we are meant to find this character somewhat irredeemable.
Also the most like energetic the editing gets. Like, it's not like super energetic, but you get a lot of cross cutting between like the room where she's dying and then the parade or whatever going on outside that he's participating in, which I think like that extra like energy into like juxtaposition by like, you know, explicit like filmmaking device, like the author like interrupting one scene to contrast it with another is something that the rest of the movie doesn't do, because it's got that kind of like almost theatrical style of letting a scene play out for like, you know, 3 or 4 minutes for each shot. But this is the part of the movie where that kind of breaks down as well.
What did you all make of, because I was thinking about this movie in conjunction with something like Ozu's The Story of Floating Weeds, which also is following Kabuki theater actors, and it's kind of interesting because this one in this movie because he goes from like the upper echelon of the Kabuki theater scene to apologies for the sports term, but like the minor leagues almost of the Kabuki theater scene, you know, it's like he kind of goes into like the secondary wave to kind of hone his skills. Yeah. And then he goes even a step lower where he goes to like the traveling theaters that are just bouncing around to different places and kind of doing these DIY makeshift shows. And that reminds me of the characters that you see in The Story of Floating Weeds, especially the color version, the later version that Ozu did, the remake of the black and white one that he did that was a silent film, where the Kabuki theater actors are more kind of these rather than just these, you know, in The Last Chrysanthemum, it's like they're these actors who are kind of they maybe don't have the skills to be on these other two levels, but they're kind of like they're working on their craft so that they can, you know, end up going up the ranks. And in Floating Weeds, it seems like they're more of like blue collar actors who are just like, this is a nice little paycheck and we get to go see the countryside.
Well, they're financially very precarious and they're left to the winds of like anywhere the wind blows, they're kind of forced to go in that direction. And I feel the Floating Weeds connection most strongly in the scene in The Last Chrysanthemum when like this is like right after the 4-year jump has happened, and they're like all the actors just hanging out backstage somewhere at a theater, and then somebody walks in and just announces, hey, by the way, we're like ending your contract earlier than we said, so we can bring in some like lady sumo wrestlers. And all of the actors are like, well, I guess I'm like broke and homeless now. I don't have anywhere to go or anything to do. And like Floating Weeds, also another connection is that it has like a real problematic dude at its center, like striving for greatness and kind of like throwing women by the wayside in so doing. Oh gosh, there's another point that I was gonna make, and class. There's a lot of interesting like stuff happening in this movie with money, and I mean, the way that we've described it is we have a character who's a terrible actor and then he becomes a great actor by the end, but this woman suffers along the way. And I don't know if we can even say that for sure. Like, I don't know if maybe this is just me not knowing enough about Kabuki theater to be able to assess his performance well enough. But I think there's also maybe a case to be made that he never really becomes a great actor. It's just kind of like the optics of class that fool people into projecting great acting onto him or something. Like, at the beginning, everyone tells him he's a great actor, even though they all know in their hearts that he's not. And then he's like, well, I'm going to go stake it out on my own. I'm going to go act in the minor leagues. And it seems like he doesn't really get a lot better. His love interest says he gets better, but we don't really see a lot of evidence of
that.
She's
a very good agent.
Yeah. And then, like, all of a sudden, when he gets, like, taken back under the banner of the family name, everybody thinks he's, like, miraculously good all of a sudden. And I don't think the movie has given us much reason to believe that he actually is at this point. Like, it's just kind of the facade of money and prestige and power that lets people believe he is.
Well, that's kind of working again on the whole, like, you know, keeping us at arm's length, because yeah, that's the point necessarily is not to see him, you know, it's not to watch him like grow into this amazing actor. That's not the overarching lesson of the movie. The lesson of the movie, as difficult as it is, is just to watch how kind of shitty this dude is, and how he kind of just uses this poor woman as kind of the stepping stool to getting to this point at the end of the movie. And so, yeah, maybe in a way that's why Mizoguchi frames it in the way that he does to kind of keep us away. Because if we were just like in there, like with close-ups, just completely engrossed in that narrative, we would be so sad immediately.
We might identify with him a little bit more. Yeah.
Well, I think also there it like shows a cynicism about maybe the process by which, like, you know, the acting world works. Like, because at the beginning of the movie, everyone's like, wow, you're so great just because of his family name. And then he, like, you know, he gets moves away from that and kind of like putters around, you know, in the kind of like squalor of the, you know, more precarious, you know, fringes of acting. And then, like, the way he gets back into acting and people like embrace him again is he goes and like they go and ask for like one of his friends who's still connected with all his old folks to come back. Like, he kind of goes and begs almost. And it, like, in a way it has the feeling of like how like John Travolta shows up every like once a decade to give a performance where everyone's like, wow, he's good again, you know? And like, but it's really just still John Travolta. And, you know, we're more interested in like the narrative arc of his career than we are like the individual performances at this point. And like, there's an element of that too, where like this guy could have gone back and begged for his place back at any point, but he chose to, you know, keep there until like the moment at which it was, you know, it made this kind of cool narrative arc to come back, you know. And I,
well, also, I mean, to connect this to the romantic relationship, the center of it, I mean, she is the one who pulls the strings to make that happen. And it's right after he has begun being physically abusive to her. So at that moment in the movie, you can definitely get the sense that, like, well, she's framing this as she's doing a kind thing for him and like getting him back in his family's good graces. But this really is like her escape hatch to get out of this relationship. And like, it also, that moment or that turn in the narrative sort of exposes the like the nepotism in the entertainment industry, if you want to call it that, because this is a guy who, you know, he had been given everything his entire life, but he doesn't really feel like that's valuable because he knows everybody's just blowing smoke up his ass, right? And he wants to make it on his own. He wants to like pull himself up by his own bootstraps and prove to everyone he's great just through sheer force of will. And he's gonna just like climb his way up the social ladder with his own honing of his skills. And like the movie ultimately shows that like you can't do that. Like even if he did become a great actor at the end, like he was no closer to achieving success than he was when he started in the minor leagues, right? And it's only when he's able to play the I'm in the prestigious aristocratic family card that he's able to get anywhere. so that's kind of an interesting like way that the whole like the arc of like greatness and meritocracy is being framed here too.
Yeah. Jessica, what did you make of the whole arc that this the main character kind of goes through, where he kind of has this woman who I guess he's in love with. Again, she's his agent. He just doesn't realize it. But like, kind of how he uses her in order to reach this pinnacle of acting.
Yeah, I guess I like didn't even really realize kind of like the steps that he was going through to become a better actor. It just seemed like he was kind of just going from job to job trying to survive, but his acting like wasn't getting any better, but there wasn't like a way for the audience to see like how his acting would get any better. Like he wasn't taking lessons or like really practicing. And it is kind of a joke also because she buys him like a mirror and is like, hey, like you can look in a mirror and practice acting because like you're not very good at it, so here's a way for you to do that. And yeah, and she more or less is just like pushing him. She's like pushing him to be better. Like, you can do this. I believe in you. I support you. I'm giving you all of my love, all of my support, all of my devotion.
And all of my like unfiltered criticism about how much
you
suck.
Yeah, and
too.
About, yeah, and, but he, and I might be wrong, but we only see the only like acting sequences that we see of his are like afterwards, like when he plays the geisha and whenever he plays like one of the lion cubs with his alongside his father and his brother. And like, I don't know if like when he is playing the geisha, he has more like feminine body language. And so they're like reading that as, oh, wow, this guy's a great actor. Like he knows how to play a geisha. So obviously like he's very good at acting. And it's like, I don't know if like he has spent all this time with a woman. And so like maybe that could have helped him like in terms of that. And then that role like could have given him the confidence to be better, like in his role as the cub, like playing underneath his father, who is supposed to be this great actor, which could be an intimidating role, but he has all this confidence now because he like aced the geisha role. And so I don't know like if that is what we're supposed to be taking from it. But I do think that it's interesting. Like I like the ending between them because it kind of like brings home to the audience of like, was it like, was all of this worth it? Like they spent these 5 years together and they were just like, they weren't like, they lost that time because they weren't good to each other. And like, I don't know. Like I think it's on purpose that it feels like all very pointless. Like all of it feels very pointless and nobody is really deriving joy from this art that they're creating. It's all, they're all trying to survive and they're trying to get money and to be higher in society, and it's not really something that they care about. It like gets lost in the process. And something that's like, and I mentioned this when I talked about the movie at first, but like the idea of like you have to, something has to be sacrificed in order to make great art. And I think that that is a theme that you can see like in movies and TV shows everywhere. And it's really interesting to me because I think that now like we're starting to break away from that. Like there are people who are trying to say like, well, you don't have to make sacrifices to make great art. You just have to like feel it. Like you have to want, you have to have the drive within you to want to create and to do it. And this is like a good example of that because he clearly doesn't. Like he doesn't have it within himself and he needs her to do it. But in the process, he is like sucking the life out of her. And like, I don't know. Like I think
we have the myth of the suffering artist in our world, right? Like you can't be a great artist unless you pay your dues and you starve for a couple years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's like obviously kind of a destructive, wrong way of thinking about things that can kind of like make people jump into like unnecessary suffering. And like what Mizoguchi's doing is maybe a little different, which is the idea that like as one person achieves greatness, they're doing it kind of like on the back of somebody else. Kind of like the idea, you know, the phrase that you've probably heard a million times, like behind every great man is a great woman. And like the woman is not the one who gets the acclaim or the prestige. But there had to have been someone, whether it's a woman or not, kind of like supporting someone on their path to achieve something. And we kind of ignore or pretend those people don't exist. Like whoever the great person is we're talking about just kind of like achieved greatness on their own. And I read a book earlier this year called What is Japanese Cinema? That it was really just a history book, kind of like going through the directors going through like the popular films of various eras. And Mizoguchi's name came up a whole lot. And at one point, the author referred to Mizoguchi as a feminist filmmaker, which is something that I don't know if I would have gotten just watching the film, but you know, with that framing in mind, I can kind of see how he's sort of like focusing in a way that a lot of people wouldn't on the pain of like essentially being a second class citizen in the period of Japanese history he's depicting. That this female character is forced to go through for the benefit of this male artist with delusions of grandeur.
Yeah, it's interesting because I saw that as well. People like in notes referring to Mizoguchi as like this feminist filmmaker, and I mean, I'm sure that's something that probably was considered at the same. I think it's one of those things that gets kind of earmarked just because, you know, we're going to go under the assumption that somebody at that period of time in history would not be considering that. And so it's like, oh, look at this welcome revelation. But I think it's also probably, I mean, I don't know what did you all make, because it's also something that do you feel like he should have given the otaku character more kind of time on her own to kind of like establish a character? Because, you know, she's constantly, her character is so intertwined with the Kiku character that she's never, you never really get a sense of who she is outside of that whole dichotomy.
Yeah, I do think like, I don't know, like I think Kiku is kind of a listless protagonist, and the most interesting character is Otaku. But she's also interesting because in some ways, like as she's presented in the movie, there's like from a modern perspective, a sort of absurdity about like what happens to her character, you know, in that she is like so devoted to him that, you know, it, you know, sucks the life force out. Even though at times you see her kind of like expressing her own will, like there is a sort of, she's kind of fulfilling a trope, but then like the interesting thing about the trope is that like she is, I think the movie maybe goes more out of its way than a lot of movies do to show like how self-destructive her presence as this trope is for herself. But I also do think that like, this is obviously not the movie that was made, but it would be interesting to see the movie in which she was actually the protagonist rather than, I mean, she's kind of the co-protagonist by the end, but definitely the early goings of the movie were more following Kiku. And his, I don't know, like there's a lot of the early parts of the movie where like, oh man, Kiku is just acting but these geishas are like really buttering him up. And he's really upset he's really like bored with that. And like, I don't know, like it definitely sets him up as kind of like, you know, it establishes the stakes of him, which is that like, you know, he's privileged because of his position, but also like unskilled and like not skilled enough to actually make that privilege like self-fulfilling, or fulfilling, I mean. But at the same point, like if the movie has these kind of like aims toward her as a character to like, you know, kind of make a commentary on her suffering, it does feel a little weird that like Kiku's the character we spend the most time with. I don't know, like her suffering being an accessory to his arc is like, of course, the point, but her suffering is an accessory to his arc. which is like kind of a weird thing for like a quote unquote like feminist movie to make. Although I realize that like maybe in the 1930s, like, you know, ideas about like female representation were different than now. And like the very fact of like her suffering being validated at all is, you know, maybe something worth, you know, marking as notable. But like it definitely like has kind of a element of like, I would like to know more about her, I guess, long story short.
Yeah, I think that one of the most moving parts of the film is, I think, maybe the only scene we get of her alone. After she has, like, successfully negotiated this deal where he gets to go back, go be back with his family, and she goes back to the little apartment over the store that they used to live in, and like lights a candle and sits in the dark and is just sad for a little while and kind of reckons with the fact that, you know, she has essentially not had a life for 5 years and doesn't really know what to do with herself when she's alone.
Right. But then we get another time jump.
And I think
And
we're not even sure how long that time jump is, which is strange.
Right. And so like at the end of that time jump, he's successful and she's dying basically. And so like, again, like, we're missing key, like, connective tissue with these characters to be able to, like, really invest in the kind of, like, long-term, like human arc that, like, a more traditionally, like, styled movie might engage, like, want you to engage in. You have, like, that one moment, and then it goes straight to, like, the extreme version of that moment in which she's, like, on her deathbed, which is, like, an interesting choice, but also, I think, again, like, to bring up the word, it's, like, a distancing choice. Because we're not allowed to, like, dwell in her suffering in the same way that we dwell in his, like, struggles as an artist. Because I think those are much more fully dramatized. Like, we just linger with him with these, like, you know, in these back, you know, green rooms or whatever the equivalent of, like, you know, backroom stages in Kabuki theater. And we don't linger with her as much. And I don't know that that's actually a bad thing in the movie. Like, I maybe got off on the wrong foot by talking about the distancing at the beginning, because I thought this movie was like pretty engaging, but like as a romance, I wasn't buying it. But like, I guess I'm not saying this necessarily as a bad thing in the movie, but it's an interesting approach that I think modern filmmaking, if you're making like a movie that's about female suffering.
Any final thoughts on the movie before we wrap up?
My final thought is we've talked about the framing and the distance and like that aspect of the cinematography, but I also just want to briefly acknowledge how beautiful this movie is on like a lighting level and like how well the shots are composed. I don't think there are many movies outside of Pedro Costa films that get like creating these beautiful dark locations so well. And I just loved looking at so many of the shots here.
Yeah, it does look really great. And like mixed with like the, I don't know if they're sets or not, but mixed with the design, like the mise-en-scene, I guess, like there's a really rich texture to the movie, which I thought was like, just great to luxuriate in, regardless of what was actually happening with the characters.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Anybody else?
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed the film. I would like to watch more of his movies. I did not get to see Ugetsu whenever you guys watched it, so it's definitely something that I want to check out. And I think that it really speaks to his work that this theme is something that other filmmakers have obviously like tried to grab onto, and I think that that's really neat.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you.
Zach, do you have a gas leak?
I don't know why
apartment?
I was thanking you guys. I'm tired.
Thank you, Patreon supporters.
Just, like, in general, to everybody. Thank you for the episode. Thank you for, yeah.
This is about gratitude. Thank you so much for sacrificing like everything for us.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, that's everything would have been better.
He never said thank you to her. He never said thank you. She was lying on her deathbed and he did not even say thank you to her.
Yeah, well, he's kind of a dick, so what are you gonna do?
let's all take a moment to thank somebody today.
thank whoever is dying of lung disease in your life for your own
thank your agents, everybody,
for your own success.
If you'd like to see more from Cinematary, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at handles at cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we list all the movies that we talked about in this episode. Thank you though to our patrons on patreon.com/cinematary. Thank you to Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Cindy Roberts, Harry Eskin, Hell Yes Small World, Joe Jordan, Maggie, Matthew Lingo, Pedro Seraphim, Ron Hayes, the kittiest of kittens, Titus Arthur, Tyler Chandler, and Whitney Rio Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. Next week on Cinematary, we'll be continuing our Young Critics Watch Old Movies series with 1941's Hell's a Poppin'. And we're going to be joined by film Twitter star, seems like a stupid term, but some well-known person on film Twitter, Peter Labuza. If you've listened to the Cinephiliacs, which is a very great podcast, if you have not listened to that before, but he's going to be joining us for the episode on Hell's a Poppin', which I'm sure Nathan is excited to finally do because he's had this on the list for like 4 straight years. So good to see that we're finally doing it. But until next week, thank you guys for listening, and we will see you then.